Lecture 3 and 4 will be devoted to the topic called calculus of variations. I'm pretty much sure that this topic is quite familiar to many of you, but for those students for whom this topic is not very familiar, so I should tell that in theoretical physics, variations or the necessity to take variational derivatives occur quite frequently. So you will do this exercise when you derive the equations of motions for fields in quantum field theory courses, the equations of motion for strings in string theory. So because of the importance, it's a good thing to spend some time talking about those issues. So there will be two lectures. So today is lecture 3 of the whole course called Evaluation of Integrals and Calculus of Variations. And today I will talk about functionals of one and many variables, then the concept of functional derivative and Euler-Lagrange equations. Then I will talk mainly as an example about Lagrangian mechanics, how those principles work when you derive the equations of motion in classical mechanics, and Noether's theorem. I hope that the time will permit me to talk about that as well. During lecture 4, that will be on Thursday, I will talk about the functional derivatives in the presence of conditions and the concept of Lagrange multipliers. So how Lagrange multipliers are introduced when you seek for a minimum of a functional rather than a function. And I will talk about the functionals for continuous systems. And possibly give an example of how to derive the stress energy tensor. Okay, any questions first of all? So if you have any questions during the lecture, please don't hesitate to contact me, to stop me and ask for what you would like to ask. Okay. First of all, let's discuss the topic called functionals. Functionals. So what is a functional? You, of course, know what the function is. So if you have a function of one, say, variable, then you have x-axis and y-axis. So and if you take a point on the x-axis, then you put in correspondence something, some number on the y-axis. So if you have some kind of a function, then to each, say, point x naught, you have another point that will be the function of x coordinate. In this sense, when you talk about a simple function of one variable for simplicity, then you put into correspondence the space, in this case of all real variables on the x-axis, into identical space of real variables that will be the function of all variables in the first space. In other words, so if you have x that belong to the space of real variables, then if the values of your function also give you real variables, then roughly speaking, the function is the correspondence, or better to say, map of the space of real variables onto the space of real variables. This is just the function. Function of one variable. So we can ask a question. Can we take a function and put into correspondence to the function the variables? The answer is yes, we can. Yes, we can. And the appropriate operation for this is integration. If we take a function and say differentiated, then we will get another function that will be the derivative of the previous function. But if we take an integral of a function or the function of that function, then we will get a number. So if we take the space of all functions, for formally, let's consider the at this point, all functions of one variable defined on the real axis between some fixed points. If we take all possible functions and impose the conditions that all those functions will be differentiable infinitely many times, this is just for our convenience, although these conditions could be relaxed as well. If we take all such functions and construct an object. So let's call it y, formally a function of x. Or better to say, not to confuse, g of x. So if this is g of x. And if we take all functions y and construct an object that will be the integral between some initial point xi and the final point xf of some arbitrary, we anticipate that we are dealing with the functions that are quite smooth and differentiable infinitely many times. So if we take the function of functions y, I will put this y as a function of x, not g of x, but anyway, of the function of x itself that varies between xi and xf, then y of x, then its first derivative, then second derivative possibly, and nth derivative. And take the integral over dx between xi and xf, then we formally put into correspondence the space of all functions y of x onto the space of real numbers j. So functional would be defined in square brackets. So if functions of argument are written in such a way that the argument stands in original brackets, then we have here square brackets. So this is the functional. We have all functions, all smooth functions that are defined between xi and xf, and consider an arbitrary function of x, this function, and the derivatives up to the nth order, and receive some kind of a number. So in a more abstract way, we essentially can say that the functional J is the map of all smooth functions, say of one variable at this point. This can be generalized, of course, for the space of many variables. So this is a map of the space of all functions onto all real numbers. This is a more mathematical and more abstract definition of what we imply when we talk about functionals. I should say that this more general form is rarely used in physical applications. So when we talk about physics applications, then quite often we have to consider the functionals that involve only either only function itself, so let me move a bit further, or the function and its first derivative. So we will consider only the functionals J of y, dx, the integral between some initial and final points, f of x, y, and y prime. So, you can consider more complicated functions, but we will be dealing only with those types. Let's ask ourselves a question. Quite often in physics, if we have a function that what we're interested in, of course, if the function is limited or bounded, we're quite often interested in minima or maxima of such functions. So if we, again, I will draw the same picture. If we have some kind of a function, smooth enough, but still having the minima or maxima, then this will be the point of maximum, and this will be the point of minimum. Of course, this is true if we have a function of one variable. If we have a function of many variables, then in addition to maxima and minima, in the same sense as we used to understand for a function of one variable, we have the so-called saddle points. But this is for functions of more than one variable. But here, if we have a function of one variable, we can ask a question where this function has a minimum and where this function has a maximum. So what is true for the point of maxima and minima? True is that the first derivative at that point is equal to zero. So if we have a function at some point, it has either a minimum or a maximum, then at those points, the first derivatives are equal to zero. Good. So can we ask a question? Can we think about some functions for that effectively maximize or minimize, in other words, extremize the functionals? Yes, we can think. We can think, and in fact, somehow through the history of physics, searching for minima or maxima, or in other words, some stationary points of functionals, was a convenient task when people aimed at the unifying description of all events, mainly many related to mechanics, because, for example, the propagation of light was considered as some kind of a mechanical movements many years ago. So people tried to answer some questions related to mechanics by looking at the minima or maxima of some functionals. For example, they tried to answer the questions why motion occurs along this or that trajectory and not the other trajectory. This is how they came up with the necessity to look for the stationary points of such objects in which we have some functions, its derivative, in this case, the first derivative, and have some number in the left-hand side of this equation. So only later it became clear that the concepts of classical mechanics developed many centuries ago became useful in quantum mechanics as well. So that's why. So how this could happen? So this is the question of the history of physics. But what is important for us? It is important to understand how to obtain the stationary points, maxima, minima, or saddle points of the functionals. So what we should do to get those? And In order to get all stationary points, in other words, to obtain equation from which one can obtain the function that render this functional stationary, we should consider such a case as a functional derivative. So the space management of has been quite poor. So I will try to write it here on this board. So functional derivative. What is this? So if we look at this functional and assume that some function is plugged here into the right-hand side, then we can say, what if we choose a function, some kind of function between xi and xf, and consider another function that has the values quite close to the original function. So in other words, we consider the small deviations from the original function and ask a question. How will this number change if we consider the small, have one function and consider the small deviations from that function? In other words, we have a function, original function, y of x, so this is y of x, and make the change of y of x into y of x plus delta y of x. This delta y is small in the limit going to zero. It can be considered infinitesimal. Infinitesimal means that it can be represented as some infinitesimally small constant epsilon times smooth bounded function eta of x. So if this is our original function, then this function will be y over x plus delta y over x. So this curve lies infinitesimally close to the original curve. And we consider what happens to the functional, to this number, when we make this substitution. The calculation that I'm going to present now is called the variation. Yes, sure. Sure, yeah. The variation. The variation of this functional. So what is this? Is delta j equal to j functional of y plus delta y minus j of y. And this is what we would like to calculate. So let me tell you that looking at this figure and in general, when we calculate the variational derivatives, we must impose the specific conditions on how function behaves at the boundary points. So we will assume that variation at the boundaries is completely absent. It is zero, meaning that delta y of xi equal to delta y of xf equal to zero. In other words, this is the fixed boundaries condition. So if we calculate this object, then let's write xi, xf, dx, f of x, y plus delta y, y prime plus delta y prime. we shouldn't, plus, yeah, we shouldn't forget also to differentiate delta y prime as well, because as you can see from here, it is still a function. Minus f of x, y, comma y prime. So what to do next? X, because delta y is infinitesimal, although a function of x itself, we expand with respect to delta y. So we have dx, df, we take the partial derivative first with respect to this argument where y stands, df over dy times delta y plus the derivative with respect to the third argument. We don't, of course, differentiate over x because infinitesimal variable here is delta y, plus df over dy prime delta y prime. Plus the higher order terms. Good. What's next? The next thing will be to get rid of the derivative delta y prime. And here we take this term and integrate it by parts. So we have the first term unchanged, but here we perform integration by parts. Delta y times df over dy, df over dy prime, sorry, taken between x2 and x1, plus integral xi xf. And here we have the following, delta y then minus d over dx of df over dy prime plus df over dy. And this is over dx. So I hope it is clear how this term was obtained and why we have minus sign here, right? So because of the fixed boundary conditions, this term disappears. It is zero because delta y at x not x2, but I have here xf and xy. But basically, x initial and x final, yeah. Good. So this term, because of fixed boundary conditions, is zero. And we are left only with this term. So let's write this term as follows, equal to, and I have to move this board up and write bigger here. So we have delta y equal to the integral between xi, xf, delta y of x, and what stands there in figure brackets, we write as follows, delta j, delta y of x, and the integral over the dx, where delta j over delta y of x is given by this, df over dy minus d over dx, df over dy prime. So this is called the functional derivative of J with respect to Y of X. So this is just the definition of a functional derivative if we have the functional of this kind. So how to interpret this object functional derivative? So what we did, we basically took the number and differentiated it with respect to a function. What is this? Well, obviously this object is a function, first of all. It's a function of x because what stands here is a function. Right, what stands here is a function. So delta j over delta y is a function. How one can view this? And one can view this as follows. If we assume that our space of variables between xi and xf is somehow discrete, not continuous, but discrete. And we have a large but fixed number of points in between xi and xf. Then we can write that if j is a function of many points, is a function of many values, say y at each points, yi at each point in between initial and final values of x, then we can write, so if j is some kind of function of those, the set of all points yi here, then we can write that the delta j is the sum over I of partial derivative dj over dyi times delta yi. And if we take, we vary the functions, the values of the function at each of these discrete points in between the final and initial points of the interval. So if we take the continuous limit, then we exactly get xf, then we exactly get what stands here. Delta j over delta y x times delta y of x. So this should be viewed as the continuous limit of this form. So the subject of taking the continuous limit or continuum limit, as people say, is quite common in physics. And especially it is useful here when you can think of the functional derivative as some kind of a continuous limit of j as a function of many, many variables that are the functions here of all points within the interval. So this interpretation is especially useful when we look, say, at the second functional derivative, and we will look at the functional derivative in a minute. So we calculated the variation. Let's ask a question. When delta j is zero, if delta j is zero, then clearly what we must have, since delta y is arbitrary, we must have that this object should be zero as well. So here I will write the theorem. So the functions for which delta j is zero are called the stationary points. Why stationary points? I will talk in a minute. Not maximum, not minimum. I will talk in a minute about why the function that rendered delta j equal to zero are called stationary points. So, but first of all, let me write down the theorem. So j of y will be stationary under fixed points variations. Y of x going to y of x plus delta y of x if and only if delta j over delta y equal to 0 for all x belonging to the segment xi, xf. So, or in other words, we must have this condition. Df over dy minus d over dx, df over dy prime equal to 0. This object is called Euler Lagrange equation. So this equation is sufficient and necessary condition for delta J to be equal to 0, basically for giving the equation for finding the stationary point solution for this functional. So any questions at this point? So this concept is not that unpleasant. One should simply understand how to derive those equations if you have the functionals of the arbitrary form. So you will have the problems during your tutorials that will just help you to understand what to do in order to find the equations that determine the stationary points of functionals. Okay, that's okay. So, any questions? So if there are no questions, I will just go to the standard examples from mechanics that will allow you to understand where this machinery of finding the stationary point of functionals work. And as I mentioned at the beginning, a very good example is classical mechanics, where people considered the object called functional, called actions. So Lagrangian, I will probably should move, yeah, should move this a little bit up if possible. Yeah, and this a little bit up, yeah. Lagrangian mechanics. So Joseph Louis Lagrange in 18th century, as well as other people, asked the question why we already have the second Newton's law in our disposal, but cannot answer the question why a particle or an object moves along this or that trajectory. So they observed, I mean, Euler Lagrange and probably other people, I'm not particularly familiar with the history or order of works and discoveries, but people observe that if they take this functional, not J, but S, as a function of, say, some one-dimensional coordinate X, and they consider this function with respect to all functions that are functions of time, not of space, but of time. So the functional of the sum functions that depends on x, x dot, where x dot is the first derivative of x with respect to time, and time itself, dt, that has one specific form, namely ti, tf, m x dot squared divided by 2 minus v of x, and the integral over dt. If they take this function and construct the Euler-Lagrange equation, and how we should construct, we should first of all look at the functional form with respect to x dot, take the derivative of this function with respect to x dot, so d over dt, our Euler-Lagrange equation with respect to dl over dx dot, minus dl over dx equal to 0 gives. If we take the derivative, we will obtain mx double dot equal to minus dv over dx. And if this function v of x is associated with potential energy, we get exactly the second Newton's law. So for this particular type of the function, we have the second Newton's law. Yes. Please speak louder. Yeah. So yes, I did not differentiate with respect to x. Yes, but exactly potentially. Where? Yeah, here. Mm-hmm. Yes. F as a function of, it can be the explicit function of x. Yes. Yes, I differentiate with respect to x the derivative of df over dy prime. So here, okay, yeah. So in general, it depends on time. So I simply assumed, okay, here, right? In principle, it can depend explicitly on x. So if it depends explicitly on x, how do I get the Euler-Lagrange equation? So okay. I see. So what confuses you is that we must also take some kind of a derivative, right? Explicitly with respect to x. The point is we consider the change of this function f under the infinitesimal additions of delta y's.
So we keep fixed.
We don't vary x because x is the variable of integration. We don't vary x. We vary only functions delta y. Only functions y. Only functions y are varied. So we cannot. Take the derivative with respect to x. If we if we consider the infinitesimally small additions with respect to functions, why we must consider the derivative only with respect to the second and third arguments? We should not vary x. So this is, of course, when we take the full derivative of this term dx or with respect to df over dy prime, then the explicit dependence on x will eventually should be taken into account. But during this derivation, all what we do is we write this way, take the derivatives with respect to y and y prime, and then integrate the second term by part. So we don't have the derivative with respect to x. This is very essential.
Into that form to show that the students made a derivative to the s.
Well. If it is not obvious, I can just explain later. But the fact that f may have an explicit dependence on x does not affect the derivation of this general form of Euler-Lagrange equation. So, okay, if you have any further questions, so just we can talk later. So in general, this can have the explicit dependence on this variable of integration. If we have an integral between Ti and Tf, then this function and this function called Lagrangian. So apparently Lagrange was the first to notice this property. So if we take this form of this function, then as a result of varying this functional, we get the second Newton's law. This is called the Lagrangian, and this functional called action. Well, quite a logical name to describe things in classical mechanics, because if something moves, something evolves or spreads, then we have some kind of an action, some kind of an activity that we could simply observe. So in mechanics, this is called an action, and in quantum mechanics, it will be called an action as well, not just simply functional, but an action. And what stands here is called Lagrangian. Lagrangian can have explicit time dependence, but again, as a result of thorough thoughts, it became clear that if the system that we want to describe is closed, basically it doesn't interact with some other systems far away, then the time dependence is absent. This is action, this is Lagrangian. And for this simple case, the variation gives the standard Newton's law. Once again, let me emphasize once again. So here in mechanics, x is the coordinate of the moving object. And they move, all the coordinates are functions of time. So let me emphasize once again that we should exercise caution when we derive the Euler-Lagrange equation. First, we should look at the functional dependence of the Lagrangian with respect to x dot. So don't put in your mind that potentially x depends on time. Just look at L as a function of, first of all, x dot, and differentiate with respect to it. Calculate the first derivative of L with respect to x dot. Substitute it here. And simply what pops up here, differentiate formally with respect to time. After that, look at L as a function of x, of the coordinate itself. And take the first derivative with respect to it. Don't first assume that you deal with functions that are themselves the functions of time. the explicit forms of x as functions of time should be found by explicit solution of those equations. So more generally, of course, more generally, if you have a function of many variables, if you have many moving objects that interact with each other, we can consider more generally so our action will be the functional of more than one variable Q. In a moment I will explain why I call those Q and their first derivative Q1 prime, Qn prime. The integral between some initial moment and final moment, L, will be also the function of Q1, Qn, and Q1 prime, Q1n prime, and possibly the function of time, dt. So this is more generally. Why did I decide to call those coordinate Q? Because those objects are in mechanics called generalized coordinates. They are not necessarily Cartesian coordinates. They are just coordinates that uniquely emphasize, describe the motion of objects in space. That's why they are called QIs, generalized coordinates. Generalized coordinates. Yeah.
Any reason you switched from prime to, from dots to primes?
Sorry about that. Dots. Thank you very, very much. Because I'm sorry. Yeah. Of course, dots. Dots. Yeah. So because in textbooks on functional analysis that are mathematical, you have primes. You have primes, but in books on mechanics, you have mainly only dots. Dots. Thank you so much. Yes. Yes. They are derivatives with respect to time, and time derivatives are denoted by dots. So those Qs are generalized coordinates. They are the set of coordinates that uniquely determine the position of objects in space. So as a very simple example what a generalized coordinate is, I will consider just, let me erase this. I will consider just the motion on a circle. So if you have a circle and say an object moving along the circle of radius r, that is constant, then the position is determined by angular variable theta. So the Lagrangian will be obtained if we substitute just the polar coordinate r cosine theta, x equal to r cosine theta, y equal to r sine theta. So if our Lagrangian in analogy with one-dimensional case, just consider the free motion, will have only kinetic term, m over 2 times x dot squared plus y dot squared. Then if you substitute, you will have m over 2 r squared times theta dot squared. So this is, and our Lagrangian will be just the function of theta dot. So this is, theta is the angular variable. Just the angular variable. This is just to illustrate that those Qs are not necessarily Cartesian coordinates. They can be radii, they can be angle, they can be small deviations, say, from some equilibrium positions. So I hope this example allows us to understand what we may be dealing with. So before I move further, I would like to comment on the following. So the Euler-Lagrange equations are the sufficient and necessary conditions for the functional of one or possibly many variables to be stationary. But what do we mean by the stationary character of our functional? Is it minimum or maximum or something in between? It's a very, very good question that not often put forward explicitly in textbooks on mechanics. So you know that if we have, say, a function of one variable, then whether the point of extremum is a minimum or a maximum is determined by the sign of the second derivative, right? Right, so here for the functionals, we can also try to look at the second functional derivatives formally. So if we consider the variation delta j of a, say, function of one variable, j y plus delta y minus j of y, then we are going to have, I will skip the limits for brevity, delta y of x times delta j over delta y of x, say, taken at y equal to y naught of x. So y naught of x solution of the Euler-Lagrange equations. Plus, look at the second derivative. That will be 1 half integral. Two integrals, delta. This is the x. So delta y 1 of x. Delta y of x1. Delta y of x2. And this second derivative, delta squared j over delta y x1, delta y x2, dx1 plus dx1 times dx2 plus higher derivatives. So this is zero, right? Because this is the first functional derivatives that gives us Euler-Lagrange equation. And this, even if it is also taken, this functional second functional derivative is also taken at y equal to y naught x, this need not to be zero. The second derivative may not be zero, and most likely it is not zero. So in order to answer the question whether we have a minimum or a maximum, we should look at the second variational derivative. So I will not be commenting on this object because we don't have time, how it may look like. It's a quite complicated thing if you start calculating it explicitly. But what we should mention here is that we can view the second functional derivative, as again the generalization, the continuum generalization of the discrete limit, as we did for the first functional derivative. So the second functional derivative is, roughly speaking, again, generalization. So this thing, this integral is the generalization of this, one half here, of this object if we assume that J is a function of many discrete variables that are the function of the set of discrete point on x-axis, then the second functional derivative is the generalization of this object. And roughly speaking, the second functional derivative can be viewed as the matrix with infinite numbers of rows and columns. Here we have all points x1, and here we have all points along, say, rows, all points x2. So if we imagine this object as a function of all discrete variables x1 and x2 that lie at the given segment, then we can view this object as a matrix and look at the eigenvalues of this infinite matrix. I emphasize that this matrix, abstract matrix, is the matrix with infinite number of rows and columns. So if we look at the eigenvalues of this matrix, and all eigenvalues will be positive, then we have a minimum. If all eigenvalues are negative, then we have the maximum. If the eigenvalues have mixed signs, then we have a saddle point solution. If we have a saddle point solution, then this means that our stationary point is essentially unstable and cannot occur in nature. Such cases are especially common in hydrodynamics. But I will not comment any more on this. For us, it is important to know that what we can find as a result of Euler-Lagrange equations can be either maximum or minimum or a saddle point. So that's why we call the solutions of Euler-Lagrange equations stationary points. So any questions at this point, because we have only 2 minutes left and probably it's a very, very good place to stop.
Yes. How can you find eigenvalues of an infinite matrix?
Tough question. It depends. In principle, apparently the best way to how probably people do, they consider the finite set of xi's, say the finite set, so n variables, xi, and then calculate the eigenvalues that are function of n, and take n going to infinity. So this may be one way, but you cannot apparently visualize this from some other perspective. So if you have, say, xi, x initial, x finite, then those points, so xi, so that's to say, yeah, so in initial, x final, then the points in between will be xi plus xf minus xi divided by n times n, where n goes from 0 to n. So if you can consider the second variational derivative of those discrete points, then find all the eigenvalues and take the limit n going to infinity, then apparently you will get the set of required eigenvalues. But apparently in the course of quantum field theory, you will have one problem that will touch upon this question. It's better to postpone the detailed discussion of this issue. But in principle, especially in the problems that involve continuous system, the motion of continuous media, it is important to investigate. Whether the found solution is a maximum or minimum, or it is a saddle point, in which case it is unstable, and thus cannot be realized in nature. By the way, in such problems where you have to investigate the stability, Euler Lagrange equations appear to be nonlinear, and thus their solution is typically not unique. Okay, that's probably all for today, and next time we will continue with first integrals and Noether's theorem, and then I will continue talking about the generalization of this machinery to continuous systems. Okay.